Hello and welcome to Giving Ventures, a podcast to help you grow your giving and change the world for the better. Each episode, we share innovative charitable efforts leveraging private philanthropy to solve public problems. I'm your host, Peter Lipset, Vice President at Donors Trust. This show is a product of Donors Trust, the oldest and largest donor advised fund focused on helping conservative and libertarian donors of all capacities simplify, protect, and grow their giving. My colleagues and I talk with a lot of groups doing great work. This show lets us share a bit of what we learned with you so you can discover new projects for your own philanthropy. Conservatives and climate progressives don't see eye to eye on very much. The extreme catastrophizing of the progressive side, coupled with painting those who are not sufficiently scared as morally bankrupt, only serves to push others on the conservative side, the free market side, towards denial, towards skepticism, and many on the conservative side simply walk away from the issue, abandoning the field to the alarmists. The progressive solution to climate change, of course, involves sweeping changes to how we do business, often reducing our freedoms of choice over many decisions in our lives, from the cars we pick to the places we go. They call instead for centralized planning for marginal emission reductions and small wins that don't seem to do what they're supposed to do. In America, we've seen this with the Green New Deal proposals, the Inflation Reduction Act, but state compacts as well, like the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative in New England, or individual states taking action. There's always California with its dictates that yield labels on pretty much everything that say you're going to get cancer by using whatever product it is. But America is not alone in this struggle. Across the pond, the spiraling costs of the European Green Deal, which imposes all these regulations and carbon pricing, etc., result in deindustrialization, uncompetitiveness, and the offshoring of a lot of emissions that are going to happen anyway. So today, we are going to explore a radically different and opposite proposal, one that says we can actually improve Earth's climate, not through top-down, high-tax impositions, but rather by expanding freedom and removing market barriers and tax burdens that benefit innovators. The idea is known as the Climate and Freedom Accord, and it has been developed by a remarkable global coalition of think tanks who have worked together to develop a framework for an international free market agreement on climate and sustainable development. This multinational, multi-group initiative leans into human nature's drive to innovate and improve and realizes that this drive is an international one because innovation comes from everywhere and no one nation can solve environmental problems alone. Joining me to talk about this unique and expansive initiative are a few of its leaders. Rod Richardson, the co-chair of the Climate and Freedom International Coalition and president of the Grace Richardson Foundation. Lord Daniel Hannan, a name that is probably familiar to many of you after his fiery speeches during his time as a member of the European Parliament, also as a leader of the Brexit movement, and now, among many hats that he wears, as the founding president of the Institute for Free Trade and a peer of the House of Lords. And we also have Diego Sanchez de la Cruz, who, among other things, is research coordinator at Instituto Juan de Mariana in Madrid. So, Rod, let's start with you. I think we have to start at the top. Give us a brief explanation of how this accord, this initiative, kind of came to pass.
Well, Peter, the roots of this idea go actually back to my dad's philosophy of philanthropy at the Smith Richardson Foundation. Smith Richardson was one of the large foundations that in the 1960s and 70s was busy funding and pioneering all of the new ideas that would become the Reagan Revolution. And all of those ideas came from a philosophy of philanthropy that said, always address the issues of the day with a better free market solution, because that's the way that you will block off bad policy and expand freedom. That if you do that consistently, that's a very good strategy on expanding global freedom. So when it came time to start the program of the Grace Richardson Fund, I looked around the world at the time, which was around 2010, and realized that the free market movement really wasn't doing a terribly good job of addressing climate with free market solutions. So the program itself quietly launched in 2015, And we realized that we needed to actually figure out how to apply free market principles to this problem, which had never been done before. How do you use free markets to address a global negative externality? Nobody really quite knew how to do that. So it required a certain amount of study and pulling together both free market experts and experts in climate and metrics and industry experts, et cetera, for different parts of this problem, to come together in expert working groups to figure out how you would do this. So between 2016 and 2020, we pulled together a whole list of different proposals about how you would use free trade and competition and private property rights and supply-side taxes to address this issue. Most recently, some of the studies that were done were quite interesting. For instance, Wayne Weingarten's study on competition, where he showed that the competitive power markets in the U.S. were decarbonizing 66% faster than the uncompetitive power markets. You know, the work that was done by him and others really showed the basis in free markets for decarbonization. All these different ideas most recently came together at three workshops last year and one this year that were hosted by the Austrian Economic Center and Students for Liberty, and pulled together groups from the newly formed Climate and Freedom International Coalition. Come together and think about, what are the, free market approaches on climate, and can we pull these together? It asks the question, if we were to imagine an international free market agreement on climate and sustainable development, what would that look like?
So what would that look like? What would be, what are the kind of top line bullets that would change if this accord that you all are working on came to pass?
Well, you have to realize that, first of all, conventional climate policy is really failing on its own terms. You know, you see in Europe, carbon pricing and regulation is leading to deindustrialization and, the offshoring of emissions, uncompetitiveness. You see in the United States that, many of these massively expensive subsidies are doing nothing for decarbonization. For instance, the ethanol subsidy, picking winners and losers is a good way to pick a lot of losers. Even things that would be winners become losers because you're making them weaker through the subsidy process. So getting rid of all the bad climate policy is the top line. But basically, the way to frame this simply is to say that this is really based on the Reagan strategy to fight stagflation. This is a replay of this at the global level. If you think about what Reagan did, right? The Reagan administration, the supply-siders around him, pursued a policy of deregulation and opening up markets, right? So they deregulated the natural gas sector, the power sector, the telecoms, the transportation, airlines. They opened up trade even more than it was already opened at the time. And all of these things created new business opportunities that were fundamentally decarbonizing, if you think about it. The fracking revolution, cell phones, computers, the internet, all led to productivity gains. Part two of that was they funded all this stuff by making the capital markets flush by using supply-side tax cuts, right? So the basic strategy, open up markets, create opportunities, and then fund that with supply-side tax cuts so that it's what you're basically doing, you're bringing down the costs for all kinds of new investment. And when you bring down the cost for new investment, what you're doing is you're speeding up the process of replacing old dirty equipment with new, cleaner, more efficient equipment. So it's basically a decarbonizing process. And what the accord does is that it globalizes that. It's a globalization of that basic strategy where nations are agreeing to a process of free market streamlining where they're getting rid of bad policy and instituting free trade, open markets, competition, stronger private property rights, private conservation frameworks, low pro-growth business taxes. And one of the carrots that is we're using to do that is a very clever new kinds of internationally reciprocal supply-side tax cuts in the form of tax-exempt debt for property, plants, and equipment, where you can have capital flows going across borders that are you know benefit from this low tax. So it's a sort of it's a global transposition of the basic Reagan strategy.
So the international component, Dan, I hope you won't mind me being a little bit amused that you were a leader in Britain in Brexit and getting rid of the top-down resolutions of Brussels and breaking away from the European Union. Yet now here you are helping to lead a cross-border resolution around climate and get a lot of people involved. So reconcile that for me and talk to me a little bit about how you are involved, particularly with your work with free trade.
Well, it's the difference between removing obstacles and imposing regulation. Edmund Burke observed that governments have great capacity to do harm, but very limited capacity to do good. And what this initiative is about is removing barriers to the innovation that will naturally lead to cleaner trade. I mean, you know, Rod began by saying free marketeers have been slow out of the blocks. We tended, you know, for a long time, climate policy was left to the left, and therefore all the solutions involved loss of sovereignty, massive regulation, redistribution of wealth, and so on. And that put a lot of people off. But actually, a conservative should be a natural conservationist, right? The clue is in the etymology. There is no better example of the Burkean ideal of a partnership between the unborn and the living and the dead than the environment, the territory to which we're attached. So how do we, instead of approaching this with state intervention, which can be ruinous and which reached its pinnacle in the smokestack industries of Eastern Europe, you know, the Soviet communism was probably the most environmentally unfriendly doctrine there's ever been. It turned the Aral Sea into a desert. It turned Lake Baikal into a sewer. You had to be told on the Volga ferry not to throw your cigarette overboard because there was so much oil, right? How do we instead incentivize the use of property rights, profit motive, free contract to get the kind of technology that we need, which is going to be the only way in which this works? The idea here is effectively that you remove barriers to the incentive to invest in new tech overseas. You extend globally the same schemes that operate within some countries where you give people tax deductible incentives to invest in new technology, because when they do that, it will be cleaner. The UK has gone from 50% of its energy being generated from coal in the late 1980s to less than 2% today. How did that happen? Did that happen through a massive program of government subsidies and state intervention? Au contraire, as we old Brussels hands say, right? It happened because the government stopped intervening, right? Stopped forcing everyone to subsidize the uncompetitive mining of coal and allowed the market to dictate cheaper and cleaner alternatives. And it happened. People will do that if they are not penalized for doing it. There's a natural incentive people have to go for cleaner and newer tech. All we have to do is remove the stones from their path.
That's really interesting. I didn't realize that about Britain and the kind of de-subsidization of coal and how that at the same time was there subsidies of other industries, or was there a period where nothing was being subsidized and things just naturally shifted?
Yes and yes. I mean, by far the biggest part of this was deregulation. We are, in fact, exactly 40 years on from the miners' strike against Margaret Thatcher, which was occasioned by her saying, we are no longer going to dig coal when it costs more to do the digging than the market value of the coal. And that was a huge traumatic moment that everyone who lived through it can remember. And yet, it paved the way for a transformation to clean energy unparalleled anywhere in the developed world. If you look at any of the carbon targets, Britain is way ahead of other developed countries because we did this basically free market thing instead of relying on grants and subsidies for renewables. We've done a bit of that laterally as well, but that's not really what drove the transformation. Now, of course, the left hate this, right? The left are in this weird double-think situation where they regret the closure of the coal mines because it put working people out, but they equally resent any suggestion that you might take to fracking or something. This weird double-think they have of mining coal good burning coal bad. But let's leave that to one side. The real lesson to take from this is trust people's sense and trust the markets. In order to be as efficient as possible, to waste as little energy as possible, to waste as little material as possible, so you want to get stuff done with as little material stuff as possible, you're pursuing your profit motive, but you are incidentally producing a cleaner product. And our first job as policymakers should be to say, what is stopping people from doing that? Where are we creating perverse incentives, and where can we remove them?
And do you think the prospects in the UK for something like this are positive, very positive? I mean, it's not going to be easy anywhere, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, actually, the UK is pretty good already at doing what Roddy is suggesting, at having these kind of cross-border tax-deductible arrangements. But I think it would be immensely good for the world, right? Here is a case where I think everyone can agree that there are global consequences, and where we therefore need to agree frameworks that get outcomes that we all benefit from. The trouble is we've been leaving that to the people who have another agenda, who don't like free trade, don't like private property, don't like capitalism at all, therefore want mammoth controls at every turn. And quite apart from being objectionable in itself, that has failed. As Rod said a moment ago, that has failed completely in its own terms as an effective way of tackling global heating, right? The only way that we're going to tackle this, unless we want to return to the Stone Age, is with technology that results in carbon capture and carbon reduction, right? There's no way that we can just, you know, stop every flight and stop every plane. And so the answer is going to come from innovation and from markets. And therefore, the most important question is, how do we encourage that to happen as quickly as possible?
May I just jump in for a second on what Dan said? There's a really interesting study by Professor Huerta de Soto from the University Francisco Marroquin, where the paper, which was done a couple of years ago, compares the UK to Denmark and Germany. In Denmark and Germany, they have used much more carbon pricing and interventionist policies. In fact, the UK's performance on decarbonization has been better than Denmark and Germany, despite their aggressive pricing. What they've done is failed to perform as well on decarbonization and increased everybody's energy costs way and above what they should be. So kudos to the UK for taking the free market pathway, which turns out to be the best way to go.
So we have a little bit of optimism for the UK. You never know what you're going to get in America. But let's talk about Spain. So, Diego, you're in Spain. Spain has long had, in addition to kind of a rough business climate, has an overuse of clean energy subsidies. And now your think tank, Instituto Juan de Mariana, is doing a series of papers comparing these conventional subsidies to the new tax proposals, tax reductions, that are in this climate accord. So what is the difference between these accord proposals and the kinds of things that Spain and, frankly, other countries have been using in the past?
Well, Peter, you know, we are the poster child of what clean energy subsidies look like and why they don't work. Let me tell you, we come from the future and we know how it looks like. So trust me here, these Green New Deals that both the US and the EU are pushing forward with are just the Spanish model on steroids. And our learning experience, of course, is the key to help avoid very costly mistakes. Now, my think tank, Instituto Juan de Mariana, where I'm the research coordinator, we were a pioneer institute in warning against this with a landmark study that was released more than a dozen years ago that made it all the way to the US Congress and effectively made the case that this would indeed not work. Now is the time, I guess, to say A, we told you so, and B, knowing that we tried the top-down approach and all we got was rising energy costs, uncompetitive energy markets, a clear slowdown in our emissions reduction, and a very costly budget deficit. What we want to do is now promote the free market approach with innovative ideas that are being put forward by this Climate and Freedom International Coalition that we're presenting here today, and that ultimately just look to push forward supply-side tax cuts, tax-exempt bonds that facilitate decarbonization, and at the end of the day, it's just free market solutions to real issues. Now, I must say, why is our work on this matter relevant? I think that, of course, Spain is one of Europe's largest economies, but we're also a key member of the, let's say, Hispanic community alongside many nations in Latin America. And we can facilitate a change in mentality, change hearts and minds within key leaders in Latin America. Think of what Madrid leader Isabel Díaz Ayuso has done to try and promote liberalism in Madrid, and how Madrid is slowly becoming the capital of capitalism in Western Europe. Or think of how Javier Milei was a regular attendee in our dinners with Professor Huerta de Soto himself, who Rod was referencing, and is now the current president of Argentina. Now, all of that work that has been done from the Hispanic liberal scene, trying to inspire conservatives worldwide, just imagine what we could do if we just bring all of that good energy and goodwill to the climate debate.
You know, one of the key differences between the Spanish subsidies and the climate and freedom tax cuts is that the clean tax cuts and even the co-victory bonds and funds that are tax-exempt debt, these are all tax rate cuts. They're not, the only deduction is the charitable deduction, and there's no tax credits in this at all. And that's very important because a tax rate cut can't create a subsidy bubble. A subsidy bubble is caused when you're transferring money to uncompetitive companies that really don't have an economic basis. A tax rate cut can only be applied to a profitable company. So you actually have profitable companies that are benefiting and growing from this. So that it's really virtually impossible to create a subsidy bubble, and it's impossible to do, you know, you don't have the kind of deindustrialization and offshoring of emissions that comes from using carbon pricing, where you're chasing people out of your market because you're using a negative incentive. You're using a positive incentive, but it's a much better one than the traditional subsidies because it's based on actual profit.
I think that's a really important point. Actually, that was one of the light bulb moments I had reading some of the materials you shared with me ahead of this, that it really is changing the incentivization. And you know, you're right. You don't get a tax cut unless you have something profitable to put out there. But anybody can take a subsidy and drive that subsidy into the ground with a failed company, as we saw back with Solyndra and so many other things here in America. And I'm sure you've seen that in Spain and in Britain. So you obviously have some really top-rate talent involved in this, present company very much included. Who else is involved? Diego mentioned the Latin American folks, I mean, names like Javier Milei. How do you get all these folks to talk to each other? And how is it just Europe and Latin America and America? How broad does it go?
I mentioned these workshops that were done at the Austrian Economic Center and the Students for Liberty conferences in Europe last year, back in April. And, you know, these pulled together a lot of free market leaders, including Dan was there, you know, for the Students for Liberty conference. And many of the think tanks that were present ended up are now engaged in doing studies on this. So that includes a study by the Institute for Free Trade. Diego's group is doing their own study at the Instituto Juan de Mariana. We also have the Warsaw Enterprise Institute doing a study with six other think tanks in Eastern and Central Europe about how to use these ideas to open up the power and energy markets in Central Europe and Eastern Europe. On top of that, we are doing a series of workshops after every Atlas Liberty Forum in Costa Rica, Madrid. I think we're going to take it to Tanzania and to New Delhi, Mont Pelerin Society. We're doing several other meetings. We're going next week. I'll be going to a meeting in Argentina with the leaders close to Javier Milei, who want to hear more about, you know, what is the Climate and Freedom Accord, and how is this something that perhaps a leader like Javier Milei could take and put it on the international stage So there's a tremendous, imagine how much attention that would get if the world's first libertarian president introduces an international free market agreement on climate and sustainable development at COP29 this year, at the UN Climate Conference. It will have about 100 times more impact and get more attention than his speech at Davos did, because it'll be this complete man bites dog story, where you have somebody who's not associated with climate saying, hey, this is actually the real approach on climate to take. It'll surprise everybody. Jaws will drop around the world.
That is great. And the collaboration, we work with a lot of donors. Donors love when different groups are collaborating. You have a huge collaboration, all these groups that many donors support, which is really, really exciting. I want to talk a second about the criticisms. I can only imagine what the criticisms on the progressive climate activist left are. I'm sure they hate everything about this because it completely circumvents and flips on the head everything they're putting for. But what about criticisms from this proposal from the right? Dan and Diego, I'm particularly interested in what you're hearing from folks. Is it this will never work? We want to do this another way? Is it let's not talk about climate, but let's still do some tax cuts? What kind of criticisms do you get from the right on this, from conservatives?
I'd say, first of all, that the criticism is overwhelmingly from the left and is very revealing. Because what that shows is something that I've always suspected about a lot, not all of them, but a lot of the leftist climate activists, which is that they don't want green growth. They want less growth. They fundamentally don't like the capitalist model. And the last thing they want is some source of free, clean energy, right? Because that would give the evil capitalist system another lease of life. The pushback on the right tends to be from people who just refuse to accept that there's a problem at all, who think that the global heating is a hoax and so on. Those who do accept that, and you can you end up having very circular conversations with those people, because if they don't think there's a problem, they're always going to object to the cost of any solution. But I think just the big picture, Peter, here is this. We can all see that over time, for market reasons, energy is going to become cleaner. There will just come a point where the extraction of fossil fuels becomes more and more expensive, and the technology driving renewables and nuclear and one day maybe fusion and whatever becomes cheaper. The only really important question for those of us in a position to influence public policy is, can we hasten that process? Is there anything we can do to tweak it so that the innovation happens more quickly, so that the crossover happens more quickly, in the way that put coal out of business in the UK? And here it seems to me is an absolutely flawless and almost cost-free way of doing that. You incentivize the profits of people who are doing the right thing. You make it easier for good ideas to spread globally. Any free trader should be in favor of this. And maybe it's a way of persuading some people on the left who are against free trade to see that actually the spread of technology is a good thing. It's not something that threatens you.
Diego, so one point on the people on the center left and is that there are many people on the center left who are not the socialist ideologues who are just interested in the government. They're seriously concerned about the issue, or they are also business people who understand the way business works. Those people I've been able to persuade that a free market approach is better. So we do have, for instance, Jigar Shah, who was the founder of SunEdison, a major company in the solar space, who wrote in 2017, 2018, that the tax-exempt bond approach was actually better than any of the subsidies that are being done, because it's more democratic. It doesn't favor the rich companies. It is a better way to go forward from a business perspective. So people like that are in fact persuadable, and that's one of the reasons that you can expect that these ideas will be able to pull centrist voters from the left over to the free market side once they're convinced that free markets are a better approach on climate.
Diego, anything you want to add to that in terms of criticisms you get?
You know, I see a lot of anger built across certain factions of the European right now against the completely misguided energy policies that have been pushed forward by Brussels, right? And having a fellow Brexiteer here, I understand that he probably saw many of these coming, and that's why he advocated for that exit, right? But for those of us who are still in the EU, it's obvious that that reaction is followed by anger. And not all everyone on the right is realizing that there is little change we can build if we just limit ourselves to denouncing what is slowly becoming more evident, which is the fact that the green agenda, as understood by the elites, mostly on the left side, and also some of the elites on the right-wing side in Europe, it's ineffective, it's very costly, and it basically brings us nowhere in terms of actually getting good results on climate or good results in economic growth. So I guess the carrot that we're extending, conservatives, is very, very attractive, and that is why most of these proposals catch many people by surprise. But then when they actually sit down and think about it, at the end of the day, freedom works in so many areas, and why wouldn't it work in an area such as climate, in which the track record that Rod brought up of so many countries conducting semi-liberal economic policy on this field has proven to be successful. By the way, when I use liberal, I mean it on the Spanish sense of the word. So I should be maybe saying conservative, okay? But I guess you get my point. So beyond that anger with these failed policies, I see lack of ideas, and that is where this agreement comes to fill a vacuum and offers concrete way forward for clean capitalism moving forward.
So speaking of moving forward, how do we get this done? As we kind of wrap up here, what is the path to actually having this accord in effect in multiple countries, ideally many, many countries? What's it going to take from a convincing leaders standpoint to just a fundraising side? I imagine there's some dollars that have to be raised for all this as well.
Well, you're right about that. You know, part of the problem with building coalitions is that I am now a victim of my own success, in that there are many different think tanks that are, you know, walking into this issue and saying, yeah, we can address this from the free market side. And it's a very exciting possibility, but it does, in fact, require funding. But which I'll get to in a second. But, you know, one of the interesting things that's going on now is that we are focusing on reaching the leaders of free market-oriented governments for the possibility of bringing this kind of idea to the global stage at COP29. So that's one of the reasons we're going to Argentina, and we'll be going to several other countries like that. And Students for Liberty is actually being very helpful with that, because they have, you know, contacts all over the world who are helping us to set up meetings and things like that. So the efforts are that, and all the different think tanks that are working on this, like the Argentinian Taxpayers Association, you know, in Argentina is hosting this. They could use funding for this. And the Libera Bolivia, you know, one Pablo Chamon Sosedo is being extremely helpful. You know, these guys could all use funding. So if donors are interested, I think there is actually a donor advised fund at Donors Trust called the Clean Capitalist Fund, where I think, Peter, can donors contact you?
Yeah, and I can put some explanation of that at the end of the show as well, on how they can utilize that to support this.
So that fund will be used to fund all of these different groups that are involved in this work. Reason Foundation, by the way, has been tremendously helpful in, you know, helping to pay bills in foreign countries for think tanks that are engaging in this. So we do have a you know, a system set up, you know, so that if donors want to tap into that, we can fund this work around the world.
Diego, you see a path forward in Spain, and as you mentioned, kind of Spain being a beacon for Latin America as well. Do you see a path forward of those countries picking up this mantle?
Absolutely. I think that in our case, there's a lot of upside because of the really, really bad results we got. You just brought up the case of Solyndra, and I recall Barack Obama explicitly naming Spain as the way to go with companies as Solyndra, and we all know how that ended. So a lot of upside here in Spain, definitely. But what I believe is also relevant is that the freedom movement in the Hispanic world is picking up steam. And those organizations like ours, which are stand ready to promote that change and get this into the agenda, can play a significant role. And the changes that are ongoing in countries like Argentina can only be seen as the result of engaged work through the years. Hanan, Daniel himself, Lord Hanan, has been a friend of ours for many years now, and he knows how many of these originated in dinners, freedom dinners in Madrid with an outspoken pundit, Javier Milei, who is now a president in his home nation of Argentina. So a lot of upside I see in the Hispanic world, and all of that support, of course, is not only necessary and needed, but also stands to make a very promising impact on our world.
Dan, you've done hard things. You led the Brexit movement. You were important to that. You've had to sit through many, many hours of European Parliament discussions. What is your take? Is this a possible thing? Can we get
there? Yeah. I mean, I'd make 2 points. First, a general point, which is it can sometimes seem dispiriting if you are supporting think tanks and you are watching that for all the good work of the think tanks, the state keeps growing, taxes keep rising, spending keeps going up, regulation keeps increasing. And it's very easy to fall into the sin of despair, to think, why are we bothering? And then you get a breakthrough. And the breakthrough could be a Margaret Thatcher or a Javier Milei, or it can be people on the left who have been kind of influenced at second hand by what you're saying. But it does make a difference. They recently formed a new government in New Zealand. It is implementing an extremely positive, radical free market agenda that was drawn up in detail by a number of Kiwi think tanks. So it is worth it. You don't know when it's going to be. It's, you know, sometimes it's like you're pouring concrete into a swamp, but then suddenly there comes a moment when you can build on it. How will this happen? Well, there'll be some kind of coalition of the willing. We have an international green free trade accord, which removes trade barriers on green technology. It's a slightly unusual coalition of countries. It's New Zealand, Fiji, Costa Rica, Switzerland, Norway. It's not an obvious grouping. It was countries that happened to have governments that saw an opportunity. And my guess is that what we and Rod are pushing will eventually take form in that way. There'll be a group of governments that say, yes, this is a good idea. Here's the framework. It's open to anyone who wants to join. And if our ideas are as convincing as we like to think, they will convince and others will join.
Well, the idea of taking everything that we believe, as you said at the top, Dan, that being a conservationist is kind of baked into the cake of being conservative, taking that principle and then applying these free market ideas to it, marrying those together to create a path forward that completely goes against everything the progressive left has been saying and yet actually does what they wanted or say they want, is a powerful thing. And so I am impressed by all of this. I encourage people to check it out, to support it. People who care about think tanks, people who care about environment, there should be a great world out there that would be interested in this. So gentlemen, thank you all very much for your time on this, and I wish you the best of luck going forward.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
There are a couple times I reference my own light bulb moment on this climate and freedom accord. My fundamental problem before, I think, was this. The climate alarmists have so steadily beat the drum that the only way to discuss solutions to a climate problem is through massive government intrusion and an erosion of our freedoms. And because of this, it is easy to miss the simplicity of an approach like the one we talked about that turns the whole paradigm on its head, that we need more freedom and more human ingenuity so that we can create a better world in all dimensions, and an improved environment is an important part of that. It won't be easy, but there are some optimistic signs, as we heard. Rod and Dan both referenced times in our past when ingenuity and deregulation have led to better environmental outcomes while also increasing prosperity. and Diego painted a clear picture of how the big statist approach can fail to deliver. We have leaders who are willing to carry the mantle of freedom forward on this, so the question now is, will they? Well, as Rod mentioned, if this is a cause you are interested in supporting, there is a fund at Donors Trust you can use to support the effort broadly, even if you are not a client of Donors Trust. You can email me. My email is plipsett@donorstrust.org, plipsett@donorstrust.org. I would be happy to help you do that. And if this is an area of interest for you, I also recommend episode 16 of Giving Ventures on free market environmentalism, where we talked to three U.S.-based groups, PERC, C3 Solutions, and American Conservation Coalition, doing great work in this area. The conservative side of the aisle has a lot of differing views on the climate debate. I get that. What we don't differ on is the importance of expanding freedom and prosperity. Rod and his crew suggested there is a way to have our cake and eat it too on this. I, for one, am going to be very interested to see how this develops. Well, I appreciate you so much tuning in and listening today. If you like this podcast, I hope you'll subscribe in the podcatcher of your choice and maybe give it a review while you're at it. Recommend it to someone who, like you, cares about growing the ideas of liberty and maybe needs an optimistic note once in a while. Until the next episode, thank you for being a giver. We'll talk more soon.